that he might have needed them even more. So in his classic Lars way, he just told them he'd think about it, and he walked to his room to get dressed for work. As he buttoned his white shirt, he was already thinking where he'd move furniture around, already thinking about the good and the bad and the deep human necessity of it all, and how anybody ever got anything done without family, and how someone could give that up in the amount of time it takes to seal an envelope with the same saliva once used to seal a marriage. Christmas is only exciting when there's a child in the middle of it, and it's lovely and sad how three adults with about 1.5 jobs between them will pile presents under a tree for a 6-month-old baby. Fiona was particularly intent on getting little Eva up to date with some modern fashions, such as baby leggings, a My Little Pony onesie, and some pink Stride-Rite shoes. The adults didn't have wish lists, but Lars was working on a surprise for Jarl. He absolutely didn't want to make it himself, but he had a lead on a butcher down south of the cities who apparently sold the freshest lutefisk in the metro area at some old family-owned shop that had been in operation for 80 years. While he was at work, Lars would make the accompanying cream sauce, which softens lutefisk from being a hostile sensory assault to merely a disgusting one, and he would surprise Jarl with the whole shebang as a big practical joke on Christmas Eve night. There was a lot to think about on Christmas Eve. The restaurant was closed, thank goodness, because Lars had planned a 5-course meal for Eva, Lars, Jarl, Fiona, and the 4 people who would drive up from West Des Moines. Fiona's sister Amy Jo, Amy Jo's art professor husband Wojtek, and their kids Rothko and Brock. Wojtek and Amy Jo were really into food and culture, or so Lars was told. They were attracted to the idea of having their Christmas Eve dinner prepared by a professional chef. That seemed to be Fiona's selling point. Lars hadn't met them yet, but being that they were driving so far out of their way and staying the night in a hotel, he felt inspired to pull out all the stops. Pork shoulder, winter squash, venison meatballs, wild rice salad, creme brulee, and of course, the surprise for Jarl. It was 10 in the morning, and Lars was just about to make the drive to the old butcher shop to acquire the key ingredient for the surprise, when Amy Jo and Wojtek Drzejelski's Mazda 626 pulled into a guest parking space outside. Lars watched from his living room window as the family, who must have left Iowa around 6 a.m. to arrive here so early, trudged through the snow toward the lobby of his building. "They're here, Fiona!" Lars called out to his brother's fiancée. Fiona and Jarl had gotten engaged a few weeks before, on Black Friday. Jarl thought they could get a better deal on rings that way. Fiona set down her magazine and leapt from the sofa. He'd never seen her move so quickly. "Let's go down and greet them at the door," she said, already putting her shoes on. The Drzejelskis looked like one of those odd families where, but for some vague physical resemblances, no two people looked like they belonged together. Amy Jo, the mother, had the dress and demeanor of a museum docent. Fiona had described her older sister as fancy and uptight. Surely she was the one to rouse the family before dawn for a 4-hour drive in the dead of winter. Wojtek, the father, had a full black beard, wore a brown leather jacket over his thick torso, and the tired, glazed-over face of a man on autopilot. The 13-year-old son Rothko, or Randy, as he apparently preferred to be called, and who could blame him, had curly rocker hair, a dangling silver earring, steel-toed boots, and a long-sleeved Guns N' Roses Appetite for Destruction shirt. Brock, the 8-year-old daughter, was a tall, stunning blonde child in an Iowa Hawkeye starter jacket and bright new Nikes. Lars watched while Fiona hugged them all, some reciprocating more willingly than others. Lars knew by now that Fiona loved her older sister and viewed Amy Jo's family as a paragon of sophistication. As Lars was introduced to them, he felt as if he was being shown off as an example of how Fiona could be sophisticated as well. I need to take a piss, Randy said, looking down at the skulls on his shirt. Randy, said his mom. Well, I do, Randy said, as if the facts and not the language had been called into question. The elevator door opened and Jarl walked out holding Eva with one hand and a grain belt premium in the other. Although she was fast asleep, she cast a spell over the six people in the lobby in the manner of most infants. Fiona frowned at the beer bottle in Jarl's hand. You sure you're okay with her? Jarl frowned back at the dumb question. Everyone knew that he was great with the baby so far, and everyone knew that the baby just loved him. Even when Eva was bawling her head off, for some reason she quit crying instantly whenever he picked her up. It was one of those things. Can I hold her? Brock shouted, lunging toward Eva, not even waiting for confirmation. Dang, she was an assertive little thing. Lars noted that Jarl easily managed to hand the baby over to Brock without setting his beer down. He was a little concerned about his baby in the arms of that brash little girl, but decided not to make a big deal out of it. He had somewhere to be. Hey, he said, I gotta run an errand south of the cities. I'll be back in about an hour or so. Fiona, you give him the tour. Got coffee and venison meatballs up there. As the Drzejowski family followed Fiona and Jarl to the elevator, Lars glanced at Randy. Oh, and no one's in the bathroom, last I checked.
Thank you, sir, Randy said,
which was not what Lars had expected to hear for some reason. And on the way to his car, he felt reassured about his strange new guests. The man behind the counter at the old small-town butcher shop had a handlebar mustache and signs on his walls that read things like, Butchers don't get old, they just lose their prime. When Lars explained that he wanted only a pound of lutefisk, the guy acted like it would be a waste of his time to get off his ass for that small a sale.
That'll hardly feed a family, the butcher said.
No one else was in the shop to help counter this argument. Frankly, it's excessive, Lars said. It's kind of an inside joke. I can't in good conscience make people actually eat it.
Yeah, you can, the butcher said. Who's in charge at your house?
Somewhere, somehow, Lars thought, this man is a blood relative of Gustav Torvald. Just a pound, he said. The butcher shook his head and sliced off a chunk of snot-colored white fish about the size of a hardcover book. The smell was nearly giving Lars PTSD, but it was worth it. He couldn't wait to see the look on Jarl's face. Have a good day, Lars said, as he left the shop.
If I have to, the old butcher said, sitting down again, relieved to be rid of the city slicker lutefisk tourist.
As Lars drove back to St. Paul, it began to snow, and on the radio he heard reports of glare ice and an accident on westbound crosstown between Minneapolis and St. Paul. He thought about Cynthia in Australia, or New Zealand, and how it was summer in that part of the world. Jarl and Fiona were so incensed that Cynthia didn't send Eva a present for Christmas that they were threatening to hire a private investigator to find out where in Australia she was. But Lars didn't want that. He'd viewed Cynthia's neglecting Eva's first Christmas as a litmus test. Confirmation that she was serious. That she was forever done with being a mother and would never come back. On the drive, he thought of a story that he'd maybe tell on Christmas. That he'd gotten a call from the police in Sydney, and they'd told him that Cynthia had died alone in a one-car accident, and they were just going to bury her out there. Cynthia wasn't close to her own mom, and her dad had died when she was a teenager, so it was perfectly feasible that no one would blow the lid off of this story. He couldn't think of anyone left in the United States who would hear the news and buy tickets to Australia for the funeral. As he climbed the stairs to his apartment, he always took the stairs now. He wondered about Cynthia's friends at the restaurant. Did she still keep in touch with any of them? With Allie, Kayla, Amber, Amy, or Sarah? He hardly spoke with them anyway. Maybe he wouldn't tell them. The concrete stairway was cold, But Jarl was right, getting into shape was important. He'd lost 4 pounds in 2 weeks, and the stairs were a big part of that. If he was ever going to attract someone who could be a good mother to his daughter, he thought he should probably at least get below 260. A person had to start somewhere. He was on the third floor landing before he realized he'd forgotten the lutefisk in the trunk, and had to go back down to get it. Well, it was an excuse to get a little bit more of a workout. Maybe he had even forgotten it subconsciously, knowing what a calorie explosion the holidays were. He jogged down the stairs, his breath clouding in his face, and kept jogging toward the rusty blue salt-streaked Dodge Omni, where he retrieved his surprise for Jarl out of the back. Halfway up the third flight of stairs, he felt a pain in his shoulder, and he gasped for air in the cold, opening his mouth. He sat down in the middle of the staircase to take a rest and felt a stabbing pain so intense he felt tired. He closed his eyes, dropping the lutefisk, leaned his head against the railing, and felt his body tumble down to the landing without him.
Chocolate Habanero. It was 7 a.m. on the day before her 11th birthday, and Eva was on her knees in her favorite stretchy blue jeans, hard at work in her closet. She was checking the dryness of her hydroponic chili plants when her mom knocked on her door. "Come in." Eva straightened her back and turned to look at her mom, Fiona, who was wearing a pantsuit the color of a serrano pepper with matching shoes and big silver hoop earrings. She looked like a shorter, wider Hillary Clinton, but with the posture and attitude of someone 58 hours into a 60-hour work week. "What kind of treat do you want to bring your class for your birthday?" Fiona asked her daughter. "I'll pick it up after work tonight if I have the energy." According to Eva, the worst birthday tradition ever in world history was the one where you had to bring some treat to class when it was your birthday. Well, she figured if she had to feed the entire sixth grade, she might as well feed them something she'd actually eat. "I was thinking vegan blueberry sorbet from New City Market." "Oh, Christ, really? Do you know what they put in ice cream, especially chocolate ice cream?" "You've told me. I'm adding years to their lives, which is more than those sewer rats deserve." Fiona shook her head. "They can't all be sewer rats. What about that nice Bethany Messerschmitt?" When it came to Eva's life, her mom had the awareness of a 50-cent guppy. There were sad-eyed janitors at school who seemed to have more insight into Eva's heart than her own parents did. At least her parents had moved the family down here to West Des Moines, Iowa, so they could be close to Eva's cool uncle, Wojciech Drzejewski, and Aunt Amy Jo, and her awesome older cousins, Rothko, who everyone called Randy, and Brock, who everyone called Brock. Bethany Messerschmitt made fun of people behind their backs all the time and had no interest in cool things like food or art or books or cool music like Randy did, though she once said Randy was a hottie, which was super weird. Worst of all, however, Bethany had called Eva a fucking Sasquatch bitch in front of everyone when Eva wouldn't lend her $5 after school at McDonald's. Even though Eva drank coffee and two or three times had tried a cigarette and did other things that were supposed to stunt her growth, she was not a particularly skinny 5'7", and there was nothing she could do about it. The kids at this new school already hated her for being younger and smarter, but since that day, she was only Sasquatch to them, and it hurt worse than anything. She didn't cry about it anymore, but the words still stabbed her brain. "Bethany Messerschmitt is dead to me," Eva said. She also didn't want to tell her mom that even the smell of McDonald's brought back this memory, because her parents loved fast food, especially McDonald's. To announce its correlation with her trauma would only make them seem thoughtless every time they brought it home, and they loved it too much to ever give it up. "Well, you need some friends your own age for once. Randy and his Mexican chef friend don't count." "The kids my age are awful. They aren't even human. Anyway, I want you to give Randy some space until he's off probation. But nobody else in the whole family even talks to him. You know, you've only got a few years left of being a kid. You should enjoy it. You have the rest of your life to be on your hands and knees working like a slave. Now hop to it. The bus will be here in 15 minutes. One of the things that Eva hated the most about being a kid was how everyone always told her that childhood was the best time of their entire lives, and don't grow up too fast, and enjoy these carefree days while you can. In those moments, her body felt like the world's smallest prison, and she escaped in her mind to her chili plants, resting on rockwool substrate under a grow light in a bedroom closet, as much a prisoner of USDA hardiness Zone 5B as she was. Unlike her, they were beautiful in a way that God intended. The tallest chocolate habanero plant came to her waist, and its firm green stalks held families of glistening gorgeous brown chilies at the end of its growing cycle. Holding them, tracing her finger around their smooth circumference, she could feel their warmth, their life, and their willingness to give. To preserve her hops for the rest of the year, she made most of them into chili powder. Her parents had learned to avoid the kitchen and order pizza when she did this. And with her first harvest this year, she made chili oil with this hot infusion recipe. 1 cup dried chilies, 2 cups grapeseed oil. Cut the dried whole chocolate habanero chilies into small pieces and put into a pan with grapeseed oil. Heat slowly over low heat until bubbles start to rise. Turn off the heat and allow the oil to cool to room temperature. Pour the chili and oil mixture into a glass bowl and cover. Store in the refrigerator for 10 days. Strain through a wine strainer into sterile bottles. She couldn't wait to try it in a recipe herself, but first wanted to bring it to her friend Araceli Pimentel, the co-executive chef at Lulu's, the best Mexican restaurant in the greater Des Moines metro area, and probably all of Iowa. But before then, she had to make it through another day. The morning bus ride was the most excruciating part of every day. Not everyone left school at the same time. Many of the worst boys stayed after to play sports, but everyone arrived at the same time, and other transportation options were scant. Just to set up her mom's fashion advice for failure, Eva wore one of the two feminine outfits she had, a navy blue dress that had two bald eagles fighting on the front. Her cousin Randy had given it to her for her birthday last year, right before he relapsed again. And she still just fit into it. Since the Bethany Messerschmitt incident at McDonald's, some of the boys and many of the girls repeated that one awful noun whenever she walked down the center aisle. To cope with it, Eva put on her Walkman and played tapes made by Cousin Randy. That day it was Tom Waits who sang about cool stuff like hookers in Minneapolis and reminded herself that all these boys would be changing her oil someday. "Hey, Sasquatch, I'm talking to you," said Chad Graybeck, a beefy soccer dolt in her class. Eva turned her head and stared out the window, but he yanked the earbud out of her left ear and whispered into it, "Sasquatch, Sasquatch, Sasquatch." One of Chad's buddies, a tall zit-faced oaf named Brant Manus, the kind of boy who liked to pop his pimples at recess and rub the pus on other kids, said, "Hey dude, why don't you just make out with her?" "You make out with her, Aunt Anus," Chad said. Dylan Sternwall, another friend of theirs, chimed in from behind Eva. "I'll pay either one of you dicklickers $5 to kiss her. On the lips." "You kiss her, Spermwall," Chad said. "Give you $5? No fucking way." "10. To the extent that this creature could think, Chad seemed to consider this for a moment. "The money first, ass munch." "No, the money second, all fees paid for services rendered." "Shit," Chad said. He leaned his face over Eva, who struggled to turn away from him. "She smells like dirt." Chad then moved in and briefly hit her cheek with his face. "There now, pay up. It's gotta be on the lips." "Hold still, Sasquatch," Chad told Eva. "I don't like this any more than you do, trust me." He smelled like cheap apple juice and was gross, like mayo oozing out of the side of a free sandwich. But there was also a coldness, an almost adult male menace to him, and perhaps only the thin decorum of this public setting prevented him from doing much more, much worse. By now the entire back half of the bus was transfixed, and the driver, a no-nonsense middle-aged lady, figured something was up. "What's going on back there? In your seats! Face front!" The kids leaning against the backs of their seats, watching the action, shielding Eva and Chad from the bus driver's mirror. The driver couldn't see Chad grab Eva's head in his hands, turn it around to face his, lick the front of her closed mouth like a popsicle, and vigorously spit out the window afterward. "Sit down back there," the driver yelled. Amid the jeering and the laughs, the kids obeyed. Eva's tall spine rattled in her body, and her hands shook as she put her earbud back into her empty left ear. She felt the mean hardness of Chad's hands linger against her skull, and tears welled up in her eyes. Still, she held them back, rubbing his touch off the sides of her head, wiping her lips, taking deep, shaky breaths. "So where's my $10? Chad asked Dylan. "Psych, dude," Dylan said. "I just wanted to see if you'd kiss her." Chad left the seat he shared with Eva to climb over to Dylan, attempting to put him in a headlock, and the driver yelled at them. That, as she would remember it, was Eva Torvald's first kiss with a boy. Eva's mom didn't know this, but Randy often picked her up after school in his cool black Volkswagen Jetta. He'd roll up to the white curb 5 minutes before the final bell, blasting Nick Cave or Nine Inch Nails or Tool out of the open windows. He had long dyed black hair and always wore black t-shirts and ripped jeans and sunglasses, making him look like a scarier Trent Reznor. To Eva and the kids her age, it was a look that spelled cool, and no one messed with Eva within 500 feet of this guy. The first time Chad and Brant and Dylan followed her out of the school, Randy just flicked his cigarette to the ground and took a hard step toward them, and those little pricks scattered like dropped gumballs. Now they didn't even leave by the same exit anymore. To Eva, Cousin Randy was an untouchable demigod, an angel's wing broken from an ancient statue, sent here to help her hover above all things insipid and heartbreaking. One morning after 7 years of excessive hydroponic indica intake, and he'd never told Eva why, exactly, he had dumped his final 3 pounds of weed into the Des Moines River. For her birthday that year, against Fiona's and Jarl's initial resistance, he'd bestowed on her his expensive grow lights and gardening hardware. He went to a place called Hazelden, a word Eva remembered from when people suggested her dad should go there after he was fired from the law office back in Minnesota. That kind of place was for people like Randy, people with real serious issues, Eva overheard Jarl say to Fiona once, not for functional guys like himself. Eva wondered if that was why Jarl didn't want to have anything to do with Randy. Maybe people who drink look down on people who use drugs just because drugs are illegal. To Eva, it was like a one-legged person being mean to a no-legged person, and she didn't understand it. In the intervening years, however, with the help of Randy's gift, Eva had evolved from a slightly tall 8-year-old struggling to grow her first jalapenos in her bedroom window box to a giant, almost 11-year-old who supplied the city's most popular Mexican restaurant with the exotic peppers for its signature dishes. She didn't need her parents to be proud of all this, if Randy was. And when she was with him, she felt part of something adult and sophisticated. His love for her made her feel like she was wearing sunglasses, even when she wasn't. Eva threw her arms around Cousin Randy when she saw him leaning against his car, and she hit him so hard with her embrace that he dropped his unfiltered Marlboro Red on the sidewalk. "Oh, shit, dog," he said, laughing. "Get in. We're going to Lulu's." "Yeah," Eva said, smiling for the first time that day since she was alone in her room that morning. In the car, speeding out of the school grounds to the music of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Cousin Randy asked whether she had her dried ground peppers with her. "Just wanted to make sure that we had a legitimate reason to stop by," he said. "I told Araceli the last time I saw her that you'd have something for her." Araceli Pimentel's cooking attracted regular customers from as far away as Fort Dodge and Ottumwa, and recently even 2 people who drove all the way from Minneapolis. This was amazing to Eva, to have people drive that far to eat something you made. She couldn't imagine it. Eva liked to fantasize that Randy and Araceli would get married, and she could move in with them and grow ingredients for the restaurant all day. Anything to be a part of it all. She told that to Randy once, and he said, "One step at a time." As they drove from West Des Moines into Des Moines, Randy asked how her day was. and Eva told him the story of what had happened on the bus. Randy swore and pounded the steering wheel, and he said he wished he were in the sixth grade again so he could shove a fist up their asses. This was the kind of thing that her parents would never say in a million billion years, and it was exactly what Eva wanted to hear. Driving with just his left hand, Randy put his right arm around her shoulder. When his hand touched her back, the strength that had willed back her emotions for the last 7 hours blew away, and tears welled up in her eyes. As she repeated what the boys on the bus had called her, she sobbed, and she wasn't even sure why she was crying. She hated those boys and knew that they were stupid, and hence their opinions were baseless and the impact of their lives on the planet would be measured only in undifferentiated emissions of methane and nitrates. But still, it hurt. And it hurt that it hurt. And she covered her eyes and buried her face over her chest, and her body shook under Randy's warm, steady hand. "Dude," he said, "you're gonna get snot all over the Eagles." At a stoplight, he looked around his car for a tissue, which of course he didn't have, so he leaned over and wiped her face with his black T-shirt. "There," he said, "you gotta keep the Eagles snot-free or they're gonna fly somewhere else." This made Eva laugh a little bit. "You know what?" Randy said. "I got an idea for those boys." "What is it?" "Gotta make sure they have something in stock first. Just don't sell Araceli all your stuff." At 3:10 p.m., the restaurant was still about 2 hours from opening, which was how Randy liked it for their visits. As they passed by the wooden benches and the coat racks in the lobby, Eva liked to stop and look at the sepia-toned portrait of the owners, Jack Daugherty and Ishmael Mendoza, and a framed Story of Lulu's that was meant to help pass the time for customers willing to tolerate a substantial wait. When she owned a restaurant, Eva decided, she was going to have the same thing in her lobby, and in her story, she was going to mention Cousin Randy and Araceli and her cousin Brock, who got a softball scholarship to Northwestern, and said that Eva could visit Chicago any time, but probably nobody else. It wasn't that she hated her parents or anything. They meant well, she knew that. But Eva just belonged somewhere else, somewhere with real important chefs like Araceli Pimentel, who didn't make time for stupid friends or stupid social events, and didn't view those choices as compromises that would ruin your life, like Eva's mom did. Araceli was sitting at the bar in her chef whites and striped pants, drinking coffee and reading a magazine, her gray-streaked black hair pulled back into a tight kitchen-ready bun. Her beautiful, makeup-free face emanated the kind of don't-mess-with-me aura of Secret Service agents and British rock stars. But she was always happy to see Eva. "Hey," Araceli said with a wide smile, shoving the magazine into her bag and slapping the bar stool next to her for Eva to slide onto. Randy went in for a hug but realized that he had snot all over his shirt just as he saw Araceli's eyes fall on it. "Allergies?" Araceli asked him. "Aw, crap, I'll be right back," Randy said, already on his way to the men's room. "Let me show you something we had to do because of you," Araceli said, rising from her stool and walking around the corner to the maitre d' station. Eva was fascinated by the empty bar, with its exotically shaped colored bottles with names like Galliano and Chinar and Midori. Randy had told her that these bottles were full of poison that ruined lives, but they looked so gorgeous, they couldn't only be evil. Eva also loved the painted Wall of Fame banner opposite the bar, meant for the survivors of the Caliente Combo. The deal was if you spent a lot of money, like $40, and ate everything on the Caliente combo plate, which was a chicken burrito, a cheese enchilada, a chili relleno, 2 carne asada tacos, and rice and beans, all infused with scant amounts of Eva's hot peppers, you got a T-shirt and your picture on the Wall of Fame. Eva was told that the Caliente combo would not exist without her chocolate habaneros. It must have been a tough plate for adults to finish because it had been on the menu since her last chili harvest, and there were only 9 pictures on the wall. The newest one was of a guy named Edgar K. Quill, who came all the way from St. Paul, Minnesota. Eva had finished the plate twice. It was a challenge to eat only because of the amount of food, not the spiciness quotient. but the owners hadn't gotten around to putting her picture on the wall or even giving her a t-shirt yet. When Araceli returned to the bar, Eva opened a menu and pointed to Abuelito Mateus's chamole. Peligro más caliente. Why did you add the warnings? People were sending it back, Araceli said. Only about 1 in 5 customers can finish it. That many Scoville units is really tough on most people. Eva's last batch of chocolate hops was just over 500,000 Scoville heat units, according to Araceli's friends at the Iowa State Food Science Lab. And that number was unbearable for most people. This new crop Eva estimated at close to double that, giving her chilies a heat index almost halfway to mace. I can do better than 500,000. It's a lot. I don't let my cooks handle them without gloves on. Eva dug around in her backpack. I've stressed them out even more this year. Why don't you bring Iowa State some of this stuff? She held up a glass pint jar, a little more than halfway full of dark brown powder, and a 4-ounce bottle filled to its cap with a tannish liquid. I have more oil at home, she said. I just wanted you to give me notes because it's the first time I've made it through hot infusion like you told me to. Araceli studied the jar. So what you're saying is this stuff is stronger than what we currently use in the chamole? Oh, unequivocally. How much can you sell me? Whoa, Randy said. Don't sell all of it. Why not? Eva asked. I have lots of overhead costs. I don't exactly plant my habaneros in dirt from the backyard, you know. Plus, I have to buy my own distilled water and special kinds of nutrients and stuff. I had an idea. Araceli, those churro bites you make, do you have like 30 of them I can buy? Araceli seemed wary. What are you going to do? It's a birthday surprise, Randy said with confidence. And then he noticed that Eva had opened the bottle of chocolate habanero chili oil and was applying it to her lips with an eyedropper. Whoa, hey, he shouted. Hey, I'm fine, Eva said, the chili oil dripping from her mouth. Oh, Christ, no, Araceli said and grabbed Eva by the arm. I'm fine, Eva said. We gotta get you some dairy, Araceli said, yanking Eva in the direction of the kitchen. Oh, no, oh, no. I'm fine, Eva repeated, as she disappeared around a corner. 20 minutes later, after the adults were calmed down from shock into mere amazement, and even asked Eva to do it again, Randy reminded everyone that they had to get her home before her parents got off work. First, Eva and Randy sat in his Jetta in Lulu's parking lot with a box of churro bites, the pint jar of chocolate habanero chili powder, and the eyedropper. For 10 minutes, they tried to inject a few flecks of the corrosive powder into a piece of churro the size of a tater tot without the latter falling apart or leaving an obvious wound. In that amount of time, they got one done decently well and screwed up 2 beyond repair. Recognizing that this is my idea, I raise a practical question at this point, Randy said. Do 6th graders even like churro bites? Sure, Eva said. Bethany Messerschmidt brought them once. They were as popular as anything that's basically sugar and fat. Randy looked at his dashboard clock. Crap. Can you finish the other 29 of these at home tonight? Eva could see that he felt guilty about leaving her with all of the work. She loved that about him. They were each outcasts in their own way, and even though he was way more fearless and tough than she'd ever be, he looked after her. And she knew nothing bad would ever happen to her if he was around. The first thing Eva did every day when she got home was go to her closet and make sure that the grow light was still on. Once or twice a year, one of the bulbs would go out, which was devastating. Every morning at 6:30, to simulate the long, hot days of tropical climates, Eva turned on the 2-foot Hydrofarm fluorescent lamp over her plants and kept it on until 10 at night. Her parents didn't like the effect on the electricity bills, but usually only complained and rarely threatened. By the time her parents got home from their jobs, Eva was sitting at the dining room table doing vocabulary homework, the one where they teach you a new word and you have to use it in a sentence. She was writing all of her sentences in iambic pentameter to make it more interesting for herself. These people didn't know what to do with someone like her. Her teacher, Mr. Ramazzotti, was a sweetheart, but spent 90% of class time managing the 5 stupidest little bastards in class who chose to create a battle out of everything, making even something as rote as taking attendance twice as long as it ought to be. Where does that leave someone who wants to have the largest pepper garden in Iowa? Did she really have to wait out 7 more soul-shredding years? It was like being told you can run free one day, in June, several years from now, but during every second of the intervening time, you'll be getting run over by the world's slowest steamroller, and every day it cracks a bone, and re-cracks it, and re-cracks it. And when you're 18, all you're going to have is a body full of dust, lifted and carried into the future like a flag loose from its mast. Eva beat her parents home, thankfully, and even had a birthday package come in the mail from her cousin Brock at Northwestern, a t-shirt of something called Bikini Kill. She didn't know what it was, probably a band, but it was from Brock, so it definitely was cool. She was finishing the second-to-last sentence of her homework when her mom came home and walked into the dining room, green pantsuit and Hillary hair disheveled from a day doing who knows what at the temp agency, lugging 2 heavy grocery sacks, dropping them on the floor of the kitchen. Eva glanced up. "How was work, Mom?" Fiona was moving milk, butter, and ice cream from the grocery bags to the refrigerator and freezer. "Good, now that it's over. Here, I picked up some chocolate chip ice cream and some little pink cups and spoons at the gas station." A frosted plastic tub of Blue Bunny ice cream thudded onto the kitchen tile. At least it was a local brand. "Sounds fine, Mom." "I'm sorry I couldn't get you that organic stuff for your class," Fiona said. "I know it's your birthday." Eva knew that her mom hadn't gotten the vegan sorbet because it was too expensive. In their home, cost was the main reason why something good didn't happen. Fiona set a small white paper carton of N.W. Gratz brand vegan blueberry sorbet in front of Eva. "So I just got a little one, just for you." Eva couldn't believe it. Her mom had driven into the city just to get it for her. She sometimes forgot that her parents were actually capable of doing nice things. Too often she could focus only on the horrifyingly unjust occasions when they prevented her from doing stuff, like when they told her that she couldn't go to the downtown farmer's market alone until she was 10, and even then didn't let her go until she was 10 and 2 months. Or their stupid rules regarding Randy. She reached for the carton, but her mom grabbed it back. "Tomorrow," Fiona said. "Save it for your birthday." Her dad, Jarl, still in his collared shirt and necktie after his day of work in the mailroom at Pioneer Seeds, grabbed a Busch Light from the door of the fridge. "Hey, Dad," Eva said, and Jarl opened his beer as he sat down at the dining room table. "Blueberry sorbet," Jarl said to no one in particular. "Is that something you could make at home?"
"Yeah, I guess," Eva said. "I hadn't thought of it."
"How was school?" her mom asked. She was reheating the leftover morning coffee in the microwave. She always did that instead of making a new batch.
"Fine," Eva said.
"What'd you do after school?"
"Nothing."
"Did Randy pick you up?"
"Yeah, but he just brought me straight home."
"Look, I can't stop you from going to Lulu's if you want. I personally don't see what's so damn special about Randy and that Mexican chef, but I know they're your favorite people in the world. Not that they buy your food or put a roof over your head or anything."
"They sure don't," her dad said, nodding as he drank his beer.
Eva rested her forehead on the dining room table and shook it back and forth as her mom spoke.
"They're nice people," she said, "and they like the same stuff I like."
"Randy didn't give you cigarettes or weed or anything."
"No, God, Mom."
"Well, still, maybe you should take a little break from Randy for a while."
"But, Mom..."
Jarl picked at the tab of his beer can. "He used to drive while high, you know. That's how he got busted. He could have killed somebody, could have killed himself."
"I know that," Eva said. "He doesn't drive stoned anymore."
"You know, I don't think he's out of the woods yet," Jarl said, "with his drug problems."
"How would you know?" Eva said, gathering her homework from the table and bolting off to her room, away from this awful conversation. "You never even talked to him." Eva thought maybe she heard Jarl say, "I just don't want to lose you," at her.
before she closed her bedroom door, but she wasn't sure. Alone at the too small child's desk in her room, Eva finished the last line of the most pointless assignment ever. And though she wanted to start on the evening's true mission immediately, she kept the box of churro bites closed under her bed. Her parents went to sleep at 10 o'clock on weeknights. Only 3.5 more hours to wait out. After a brazenly lifeless dinner of fish sticks and frozen peas, Eva scurried back to her room. Fortunately, neither of her parents had brought up Randy again. If they had, Eva would have gotten up from the table that second. She was sitting on her bed reading recipes in an old copy of James Beard's Beard on Bread. She found that book comforting for some reason, when her dad, smelling like sweat and warm beer, knocked on her door and opened it. He was still wearing a tie, but now also had on sweatpants cut off at the knees. Probably the dorkiest outfit of all time. "Yes?" Eva asked, looking at her dad's face as his wide, soft body filled up the doorway. "How's it going?" Jarl asked. "Is everything okay?" Eva nodded, not setting down her book. "Yep," she said. "You don't seem very excited about your birthday tomorrow, is all. Are things still better at school?" A month ago, after some girls dumped a 32-ounce Pepsi on her head during recess, she had made the mistake of telling her dad, who called the school, who talked to the girls, and this made things even worse. Because now she was a narc and a snitch bitch, in addition to being Sasquatch. "Yeah," Eva said. "You can tell me. You can tell me anything. You come to me first, not Randy." Ah, that's what this was about. It was as much an anti-Randy message as a pro-dad message, even if her dad did somehow believe he could actually protect her from that horrible world that started where their driveway stopped. "I will," Eva said. "Okay," Jarl said. He suddenly looked sad and bewildered, like an elephant that had been fired from the circus and was wandering down the side of the highway with nowhere to go. The thought occurred to Eva that if her dad confronted those boys face to face, they'd make fun of her weak, fat, kind-hearted father, as brutally as they made fun of her. And she needed to protect her dad from that. His ego was already so fragile. "Everything's better, Dad, I promise." "Happy day before your birthday," he said, and smiled at her as he closed her bedroom door. "I love you, you know. We love you." "Yeah, I know that," Eva said in reply. They did. She knew that. Eva knew that Jarl's big brother Lars had died of a heart attack a few months after she was born, and it probably made them both paranoid about losing another family member. Eva didn't remember Lars, because obviously she wouldn't, but apparently he was a super nice guy who really helped out Fiona and Jarl a ton when they were just starting out. And he'd been a chef, which was awesome. It was incredible knowing she'd actually been related to one. Her other uncle on that side also used to run a bakery way up in Duluth, but he sold it about 6 years ago, and they never saw him anyway. But Lars Torvald, everyone said, was a legend in the kitchen. Her parents, on the other hand, worked about as far away from a kitchen as you could get. Until a couple of years ago, Fiona was an independent sales consultant for Madison May Cosmetics, but lately had been temping because she said she wanted to work in an office environment, and it seemed like a good way to try out different ones. Jarl, meanwhile, had been at the same mailroom job at Pioneer Seeds for 3 years now, a record. They each worked hard and barely seemed to spend any money on stuff just for themselves. And noticing the kind of stuff that the parents of other kids bought and hers didn't, snowmobiles, camping trips, cruise ship vacations, Eva wondered if they ever would. What happened to all the money her parents earned? Eva wasn't sure. Maybe it was true. Maybe it was, as her mom said, all just going to the house and car payments and barely keeping them afloat. And that was why the dryer was loud, and the deck wasn't going to be repainted any time soon, and why there was no handle on the toilet, and you had to reach inside the back part to flush it. Fiona said they were one emergency from everything falling apart. But it didn't feel like it to Eva. Their home felt safe. She could have a pepper garden in her closet and take buses around the city alone and sneak time with Randy if she was careful. And when things did go bad, like they often did at school, she could decide for herself how to respond. Sure, maybe the churro bites were Randy's idea, but it was up to her to execute it. And she would. After she was sure that her parents were asleep, Eva got up and sat at the vanity in her room with the box of churro bites and the pint jar of crushed peppers. She remembered Araceli saying that half a teaspoon spread over an entire meal was still too much for 80% of full-grown Iowan adults who ordered the chamole dish. It sent them coughing and gasping to the bathroom or downing whole glasses of milk after two bites. Half a teaspoon over maybe 2 pounds of food. She thought about Chad Graybeck and Dylan Sternwall and Brant Manus and Bethany Messerschmidt as she carefully injected a full teaspoon of chili powder into the sugary guts of each 1 ounce churro bite, again and again. She stopped once to consider whether a straight full teaspoon was excessive. Although she had no friends in the class, perhaps not everyone deserved to have the sensation of their taste buds seared off, let alone burning diarrhea. All she knew was that there was no way that Chad or Brant or any of those assholes should accidentally end up with the one that had no chocolate habanero, so therefore she had to severely doctor them all. When she was done, a little before midnight, she licked the cinnamon and sugar and her chocolate habanero pepper powder off her fingers all at once, feeling the severe, pleasant burning on her lips and mouth. She was pretty sure that in her 3+ years of handling and eating extremely hot peppers, she had exhausted most of the substance P from the soft tissues in her mouth and hands, which didn't replenish even as she got older. The main reason she began growing increasingly hot exotic peppers was to find something with enough capsaicin to release the endorphins that became more and more inaccessible with increased heat tolerance. She wanted to feel lava blossoming in her eyes and nose and mouth again, like the first time she ate a regular habanero with Cousin Randy, back when he was still allowed to babysit her. She cleaned out her last teaspoon of chili powder in the jar with a wet finger and put it on her tongue and let the graceless heat savage her soft tissues as she lay on her bed, closed her eyes, felt the angels in her blood begin to sing, and officially turned 11. Her mom offered her a ride to school the next morning, which was rare, and normally Eva would have jumped at it, but that would mean revealing the churro bites and not being able to accidentally forget the ice cream, so she took the dreaded bus instead. She sat 2 seats behind the driver, which she hated doing because it was dorky and fearful, and only the little kids sat way up front. That day there was no escaping the awful boys either way. "Hey, scrotum breath," Dylan Sternwall, seated 4 seats behind Eva, said to Chad. $10 if you kiss Sasquatch again. Give me the money first, gerbil dick." Dylan took a crumbled $20 bill out of his pocket. "I'll pay you for this time and the last time. After services rendered." "You hear that, Sasquatch?" Chad said. "I'm gonna get you again today. Outside. If you go running into the school, I'm going to depants you." Eva could only nod in response and look at the bus floor. Depantsing was the highest of the high-level threats. Even if they succeeded, Eva knew that punishment would be elusive for these boys, especially when their dads were high school coaches and managed car dealerships and were far richer and more popular around town than her own little family. Once or twice she had overheard people calling her parents white trash, and she had quickly figured out that no one protects or stands up for white trash, and no one on the outside ever would. To be called white trash is to be told that you're on your own. "Meet us at the end of the fence around the corner." That was off school property. Eva nodded again. She saw him stare at her box of churro bites. "Is that Mexican crap for school?" he asked. "That shit sucks." Chad grabbed the box from her in one move with his greasy boy hands and held it over her head. Eva leaped to her feet. "Give it back!" "What was that?" the bus driver yelled. Chad slid to a seat across the aisle, crushing a couple of third graders with his chunky body, and slid the box out an open window. "Whoops," he said. "No!" Eva pulled down her window and looked out to see just the faintest glimpse of a lavender box tumbling on the road. The bus driver stopped the bus and turned around, looking right at Chad. "You, after I drop you off today, you are suspended from this bus."
"You can't do that," Chad smiled. "How am I going to get to school?"
"Come up here," the driver said, pointing to a seat right behind her. Chad's friends made hubba hubba noises as Chad took his time getting to the front of the bus. He paused only to flick his tongue at Eva, who had her head in her hands and saw hardly any of it. After a minute, a block before the bus arrived at school, Eva removed the little bottle of concentrated chili oil from her backpack. She first smeared some on her fingertips and then poured the rest in her mouth, holding it there like mouthwash. Even with her heat-ravaged mouth and hands, this stuff was special. It felt like the skin on her fingers and the inside walls of her mouth were searing off. She even glanced down once to see whether the skin on her fingers was actually peeling. She held a placid expression as she stepped out of the bus and made a right when every other student was making a left. She walked to the end of the block and turned at the fence, hearing Dylan, Chad, and Brandt laughing behind her, closing the gap. Then, by the fence at the official edge of school property, she waited. As the boys surrounded her, she stood as still as a pot of dry soil, holding the fire in her cheeks. Maybe things would have gone according to plan if Chad hadn't come up to her from behind and whipped her around, the shock of which made her spit the entire mouthful of searing pepper oil onto his face before he even kissed her. As Chad fell on the grass screaming, Eva stared at him for a second. It was really working. She reached over and grabbed Dylan's head and wiped her chili oil dripping fingers across his eyes, actually feeling his eyeballs under her fingertips. Screaming, he shoved her off and fell against the pole on the edge of the chain-link fence, shouting, crying, and grasping Oedipally at his face. Brandt got one look at Eva, her mouth and fingers red and swollen from the oil. Between that and hearing the cries of his friends, his flight instinct kicked in, and he ran toward the school as fast as Eva had ever seen a boy run. Chad was kneeling in the open lawn, fists uprooting handfuls of grass and dirt to wipe against the fire consuming his face, and was screaming, as was Dylan, who was still clawing at his eyes and weeping, long since having dropped his $20 bill, which Eva picked up, folded, and shoved in Chad's fat back pocket. She then collected herself and walked toward the school. Eva didn't even make it more than 2 feet into her classroom before she was once again approached from behind, this time by stern adults, and whisked into the principal's office. The look on sweet old Mr. Ramazzotti's face seemed to say, "Why her? She's one of my good ones." As she was escorted past the secretarial pool area of the front desk administrators, she heard an ambulance being called. The principal opened a heavy wooden door to what Eva judged to be the second fanciest office she'd ever seen after her dad's boss's office that one time, and followed the principal's stern orders to sit down in a chair facing the desk. Just when the principal asked, "What did you do to those boys?" Eva could hear Dylan Sternwall crying, wailing, really. She never heard a boy her age cry so loud as he was brought to the nurse's office. What a fantastic noise. She curled her hot, swollen lips over her teeth to fight back the smile and look contrite. There was no going back from this. She had just pushed her life forward in a particular direction, and as the principal lifted her cordless desk phone to call Eva's mother, Eva saw that not all of it was going to be as pleasant as this moment. So while the phone rang at her mom's work, she leaned back in her chair, listened to the astonishing sounds of justice, and no longer pretended to look sorry. Sweet Pepper Jelly. Brock Drzelski's schedule for June 2nd. 5:30 a.m. Off my ass and out of bed. Hot lemon water, about 0 calories. Morning ablutions. 5:50 a.m. Breakfast. Almond butter, avo and banana sandwich, egg whites, about 800 calories. 6:20 a.m., shower, water temperature, about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. 6:30 a.m., study for 210-2 U.S. History Final. 8:10 a.m., meet Patricia at SPAC, 20 minutes of cardio, 70 minutes of core and weights. 9:40 a.m., shower, water temperature, about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. 9:50 a.m., leave SPAC, drink protein shake, about 200 calories. 10 a.m., lunch at Whole Foods Hot Bar, about 600 calories. 10:30 a.m., 3:10:1 Micro 1 discussion group. 11:50 a.m., leave Micro 1 discussion group. 12 p.m., U.S. History discussion group. 12:50 p.m., leave U.S. History discussion group. 1 p.m., second lunch, grilled chicken, brown rice, steamed veggies, about 550 calories. 1:30 p.m., study for 2030 French oral final presentation. 3 p.m., French oral workshop. 3:50 p.m., leave French oral workshop. 4 p.m., change, short jog around Lakeville. 4:40 p.m., small dinner, mixed greens, quinoa, protein shake, about 350 calories. 5 p.m., study for 2:15 economy and society final. 7 p.m., snack, apple, raw carrot, kombucha, about 200 calories. 7:15 p.m., study for micro one final. 9:15 p.m., final snack, a third cup avocado on 6 whole wheat crackers, about 200 calories. 9:30 p.m., return outstanding emails, text, phone calls, write schedule for tomorrow. 10:30 p.m., lights out, no exceptions. 8:03 a.m. People in Evanston move so goddamn slow. It was one thing when the sidewalks were covered in ice and lake-effect snow, but this was June, the day after Brock's cousin Eva's birthday, which used to mean a big family party marking the beginning of summer, at least before her dad left and her brother Randy went to rehab. Back then, when they were all together, Brock's mom used to say that Iowans knew how to appreciate the two most precious things in life, family and warm weather. Given that summer in Iowa was often fleeting, her mom was making one hell of a poignant juxtaposition, especially considering what had happened and what that batshit crazy woman had done and still did to everybody. Still, once in a great damn while, Brock did hear those words as her mother intended, and in particular, they came to mind today, in this dismally temperate Chicago suburb, as the lumpy assholes on Clark Street refused to move aside for a runner who was out taking full advantage of the first beautiful day of the year. The slow, sad-faced suburban ass clowns weren't even the worst part about the morning so far. Across the street on the corner of Clark and Orrington Avenue, the greasy egg fart odor of the Burger King made Brock cover her face. It always smelled like ass, but today it was so overpowering she wanted to puke. Worse, the damn smell was also somehow alluring. She had to beat back memories of visiting her Aunt Fiona and Uncle Jarl and getting bags of delicious, slimy fast food for lunch. Shit, she used to love that BK Big Fish sandwich. 32 grams of fat, 1,370 milligrams of sodium, 91% of your recommended daily intake. Awful feeding that to a kid. At least now, in the year 2000, those places also had supposedly healthy menu options, but still, that smell. She could detect fish in the greasy breeze. She swore. Ha, what if she had one? Just one time. Or half of one. But fuck that. Fuck that in the face. Bad, fat, empty calories. And they put HFCS in everything, even the bun. She'd kill her gut, and as a bonus have a goddamn sugar crash. No thanks, Hank. Jogging onto the campus, she washed out her olfactory system with the smells of wet sidewalk, the freshly mown grass of Deering Meadow, and the explosive lavender of the Shakespeare Garden. The lavender was bloomy as fuck and did the trick. All better. After she swiped her wildcard student ID at the gym's front desk, she noticed that everything at SPAC seemed doused in the citrusy alcohol-based cleaner they used to wipe down the equipment. People were so anal about each other's sweat and germs, especially the weekend warriors and non-competitive athletes. Brock was a softball player. That's a life in the dirt. A life touching dirt. A life touching things that touch dirt. Did Dot Richardson sterilize everything she touched until she was handed a gold medal? As if. Brock waited until she knew people were looking at her, then spat in her hands and lifted a 17.5-pound kettlebell from the rack. Patricia Bernal, her workout partner and fellow academic All-American award-winning softball player, would be here in 30 minutes to spot her, and she'd do K-bell swings and stairs until then. It was hardly more difficult to do swings with a 17.5-pounder as opposed to her usual 15, but today, ugh. It didn't feel like abdominal tightening. It felt like a fist had been broken through her intestinal wall and extended its fingers inside her. She felt the bile chuckling in her throat. The kettlebell clanked to the floor. She stood facing the toilet, tasting the bile she spit into the water. She could hear another woman vomit a few stalls.